You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Major League Baseball announced that four umpires have been named to the full-time staff. They replaced four others who had aggregate service totaling 122 years. About a quarter of those, 33 years, belongs to our guest, whose major league career began in 1984. Only 18 umpires have had longer service time, and we welcome to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball, Tim Welke. Tim, it's great to have you. Thank you. Thank you so much. This was an unusual retirement in the sense that you were on the disabled list in 2016, so in point of fact, you've not worked on the field for 2 years.
Hi, Ed. Yeah, glad to be here. That's correct. Last January, the last year I worked in the big leagues was 2015. I worked the entire year in 15. And then in that November, we made the decision that it was I couldn't go any farther with my knees. So bone on bone, and it became very painful to stand out there for the 3 or 4 hours and work the plate and then go to third base. So in January of 2016, I had a left total knee replacement, and in June of last year, I had the right total knee replacement. And it's the best thing I ever did because now I'm sleeping better, feeling better, my quality of life is much better, and I'm ready for the next chapter.
Was that a tough decision to walk away?
You know what, Ed, I really miss the guys, and I miss wearing the uniform. But I did it for a long time, and I was very fortunate. I got to work with a lot of great people and run into a lot of terrific baseball players and managers and that sort of thing. So, and I knew the last couple of years I was in a lot of pain, and just you can only ice only works so much before the game and only so much after the game. So my body just couldn't go any farther, and I didn't want my skills to deteriorate, and just go out there and stand, because you just can't go out there and stand. You got to hustle. You got to be in the proper position to make the correct decisions, and but it's a good thing. I can no longer work, even though having the knees replaced, because I can ride a bike and do things like that, but I can't run yet or those sort of things. But it's okay. It's okay. It was a great career, and it went by in a hurry, which means I had fun.
Yeah, but nobody's yelling at you anymore either. That's another one of the upsides here.
You got that right. You got that right. And that's a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing. And I can just be a fan. I had lunch today with my mom, and she, of course, she had the Tigers home opener on because she's a big Tiger fan.
Right.
So that's neat to see. And you don't care. Umpires don't care who wins or loses the game. You just, you pull for the good people. And I know she's a big fan. She was a big fan of Ernie Harwell growing up.
Of course.
The longtime radio voice of the Detroit Tigers. And growing up back, there maybe were 20 games on a year on TV. And, of course, now every game's on TV. But back then you used to listen to the radio. And,
right.
And people like Ernie Harwell left a lasting impression on my life growing up because the radio was always on in the kitchen. And then I'm fortunate enough, to work in the American League all those years. And then when we came in 2000, we became Major League umpires. So I crossed paths with Ernie several times.
Oh, my goodness.
What a great voice.
The best ever. The best,
yep.
One of the five best people I've ever met in my life. There was a story about him that I'll never forget. A man owned a very small gas station in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. And a guy pulls in. Very, very late in the day, and the guy did not want to serve him, and the motorist said, I need gas. He said, I'm sorry, it's 5 minutes to Ernie. That's what he said. It's 5 minutes to Ernie. I got to close. But that's
were a lot of years where Ernie Harwell was the star of the Tigers. I think he always was the star of the Tigers, but how enjoyable he made it for the people of Michigan and in the Midwest.
It, to go back to the physical toll of being an umpire for 33 years, I don't think, Tim, and I speak on behalf of other people, and that's probably a mistake, but I get the sense nobody really has an idea the physical toll the game takes on the umpires through the years.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's we just don't show up and work the 3 or 3.5 hours. We're there hour and a half, hour 45 before the game, getting ready, going over rules and studying tape and that sort of thing. We're there at least an hour after the game, and of course we travel much more than the players do. The players, play half their games in the city that they play for, and we don't have home ballparks. So that's why we're moving all the time, and a lot of hotels and a lot of airports and that sort of thing. But it works, and, you know, I always told people, hey, it's a great job in the winter. You have about 3 or 4 months off where you can get healthy and get ready for spring training and do it all over again.
You began umpiring kids' games in the summer at age 16. You remember what the pay was, and did you have the nerve at age 16 to throw anybody out?
I don't think I threw anybody out, but I obviously didn't know what I was doing. I think the first time I ever was paid to umpire a game, it was a summer league American Legion type game for $2, and I often remember that. But after working summer baseball and being yelled at by coaches and players for not being very good at what I was doing, I said, hey, I'll go to an umpire school. I'll learn how to be a better umpire. I'll come back home and do high school and college, and they'll quit yelling at me. Well, that was about 40-plus years ago, and they yelled at me for 40 years, but as you said, nobody yells at me anymore.
No. What attracted you, though, to want to pursue umpiring?
I never had the professional ambition. I always wanted to just be a basketball coach and maybe a high school teacher. Those are the people that influenced me in my life when I was growing up. But I went to a small high school, played all the sports, basketball, baseball, football. I love sports. Wasn't the best player, but I was always out there playing. I figured it'd be a nice way to make extra money in the summer, help pay for my college. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I knew I wanted to get better at it because I wanted, as I said earlier, to do high school games and college games and know what I was doing. And I'm sure most umpires have that same, especially the amateur umpires. The only good thing is being a professional umpire, 6 years in the minor leagues and then 33 years in the major leagues, is I didn't have to yell at the mom. The moms didn't yell at me.
Yeah.
The high school and the little league moms didn't yell at me. So.
They were very polite. You went to umpiring school at 19 with the intention, as you said, of just umpiring high school and college. But then when you got to umpiring school, when did you first have the thought, I think I want to do this with my life?
Well, they have a couple umpire schools, and I went to one in Florida. It was at the time Al Summers Umpire School, which shortly thereafter became the Harry Wendelstedt Umpire School. And there was like 150 people there, and they take the top finishers and they plug them into the very low minor leagues, and it's kind of like just the way a player moves through the minor leagues.
Right.
You start out in rookie ball, A ball, Double A, Triple A, and it's the same thing for umpires. And you try to do the best you can at each level. You work winter ball. I spent a couple winters in the Dominican Republic, worked instructional leagues, and then. You get a taste of it, and you realize, hey, I can be better at this when I get more experience. And you just keep working at it, plugging away. And then it's like a lot of things in life. You have to be in the right place at the right time. And when I went to AAA, I worked with Tim McClellan and Drew Coble, who both had long major league careers and were great umpires. And that was a AAA crew. And the American League was coming around scouting them, the supervisors, the umpire supervisors. And they got a chance to see me. I was just a young kid with maybe potential, and that's really what it takes. And somebody got hurt in 1983. A couple guys got hurt, so I filled in about 75 games in the summer of 1983. And then in January 1st of 1984, I became full-time. So right place at the right time, and I was 25 years old and no experience, but I had a lot of great mentors along the way, people like Marty Springstead. Your fans will know that name, obviously, long career, long
he was great.
Supervisor. I worked a lot with Jim Evans and Joe Brinkman and Richie Garcia and people, Don Denkinger, people along the way were very good and really helped me immensely to get better. And it takes a long time to get the experience to be comfortable at the major league level. And my bosses were very patient with me, let's say that.
What do you remember about the Gulf Coast League in 1977, your first professional assignment? And we should mention that in the Gulf Coast League, nobody goes to the games.
Nobody goes.
The players are there because they have to be. The manager is there. The umpires are there. That's it. There's nobody there.
There's nobody there. That's where all the rookies who were drafted early in June go report to for their teams. And I remember it was so hot. It was based out of Sarasota, Florida, and then we went to Bradenton and that area. But they would play the games at 10 in the morning because it was so hot.
Right.
But there were players there at that time that ended up making the big leagues. People like Rod Allen played in that league, and Frank Wren was a very good player, and then ended up becoming a longtime major league executive.
Right.
So I'd run into those people, and then I went to A-ball, and my first year in the Florida State League, my second year in the Florida State League, I was partners with Pam Postuma all season, and she was a female umpire.
I'm going to have her on the show. She just wrote a book.
Yeah. It was kind of a novelty, but we had a wonderful time caravanning around the Florida State League, and from time to time, I'd run into Rex Hudler. He played for the Fort Lauderdale Yankees at the time. In fact, I just communicated with him back and forth a couple days ago. He's a broadcaster now with the Royals and has been for a long time. But he's a guy that's always got a great personality.
He never for a loss of words.
Yeah. So I met him 40 plus years ago, and he sent me a nice text. I answered him back, and he sent me back another text. So.
Uh-huh.
It's nice to be able to, when you run into good people, and that's what you remember, the good people. You don't remember the tough calls or the tough games or the 16-inning games. You remember the really great people, and our profession has so many of them.
Tim Welke is with us, now a man of leisure after 33 years in the major leagues and another six in the minors before that. You're up at 25 years old, which seems awful young, but obviously on merit. When you're in the minor leagues, do you know that you're being watched?
You're constantly evaluated. You have minor league presidents, and the umpire development program, which covers the minor leagues, would always send out supervisors, not to all the games, but when they were in town, they'd come in the locker room before the game, after the game. I remember Marty Springstead telling me at the time, he said, work every game like you think somebody's always there watching you.
Mm.
So I took
good
that
advice.
Part, and it didn't matter whether you're working in front of 900 people and it's a rainy Tuesday night, or you're working in AAA 8,000 people, and there's a supervisor in the stands. If you work every day like somebody's watching you and try to do your best, and I always try to keep that style, and I think that's what helped me get promoted. That, and I was young, so I was only... The upside was only going to get better, and once I got more experience. Okay.
Tell us about your first game in June of '83.
Well, it was in Toronto, Canada. Oakland was there. Larry Barnett was the crew chief of the crew, but he wasn't there. He got injured the night before in Detroit. So I joined Vic Vitaggio and Mike Riley and Dan Morrison, and I went to first base my very first game. And you always remember, even though it was so long ago, then the second night I had the plate, and the pitchers were Louis Leal pitched against Bill Krueger.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I can remember that. I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but you can remember things like that. Those are milestones, and it becomes I was married, had a young child at the time, so it takes your family to get you there, and then... like I said, then I worked with that crew for a week or so, and then somebody else got hurt. Steve Palermo, I think, the 4th of July in 1983, had the plate in Yankee Stadium, and that's when Dave Righetti threw a no-hitter. And late in that game, Steve Palermo went back towards there was a foul pop-up back by the screen, and he kind of twisted his knee the wrong way and ended up tearing ligaments or whatever. So he was going to miss 6 weeks, so I got recalled up from the minor leagues, and I spent the rest of the year in the big leagues. So that's how I got my foot in the door and got an opportunity and took advantage of it.
There's a funny story about the Yankees playing Kansas City and an encounter you had with Billy Martin, who had a way of getting on the umpires.
Yes. It was like the second week I was with Larry Barnett's crew, 2 weeks into my career as a young umpire, not really knowing what I'm doing and hoping I wouldn't do anything to screw up my opportunity. Late in the game, the Yankees and the Royals were 1-1, and Mickey Rivers was the hitter for the Yankees, and he hit a high fly ball to center field, and Amos Otis, the Royal center fielder, dove for the ball, missed it, and that's back when Kansas City had that AstroTurf. So the ball bounced really high, rolled to the wall. So Mickey Rivers rounds the bases, scores. Now the Yankees are ahead 2-1, and being the second base umpire, I saw Mickey Rivers miss second base. And I'm kind of saying to myself, gosh, I hope they don't appeal second base, because if they do, I got to call them out, and the score's not 2-1, it's 1-1. And the next thing I hear George Brett yell to Frank White, Brett being the Royals' third baseman, yell to Frank White, the second baseman, hey, Frank, I think he missed second base. So the Royals get the ball and then throw to second base and you know, make the appeal that Rivers missed second base. And I did what you're supposed to do. I called him out. And then I kind of looked up, and I see this little short guy, New York, on his chest just running right at me. And, of course, it's Billy Martin. And I said to myself, he's going to just run into me. This is going to be terrible, because he had that, you know, he wasn't afraid to kick dirt on people and bump people and that sort of thing. And I figured, geez, I'll draw attention to myself, and I'm going to hurt my career before as it's just getting started. But he stopped just before me, put his finger underneath my chin, because he was, you know, maybe 5'8", and I'm 6'3". And he said, let me tell you one thing, young man. I'm going to fine him $100 because I saw him miss second base, too. And I did what you just did. I laughed, and he said, don't you laugh. We're on TV. Well, I said to myself in the locker room after the game, I said to the guys, I guess if you get them right up here, they just kind of leave you alone. And the crew kind of laughed. And later that summer, I was in Texas, and I had the plate, and Billy Martin didn't like something, and he came out, and he started to kick dirt. And I learned very early in my career, of course, I ejected Billy Martin. Like I said, this is just 2 or 3 weeks later. I learned very early in my career, if they're starting to kick dirt, you better walk to grass. So I walked out of the dirt circle, went to the grass, and he couldn't kick dirt on me anymore.
There is, I think you'll admit, we're with Tim Welke, I think you will admit there's a difference in the tenor of the way in which managers conduct themselves now than they did in the past. It's a lot different than it was back years ago, Tim, with Herzog and Sparky and Dick Williams and Billy Martin. It's a lot different now.
No question about it, Ed. Back then, I think sometimes they would yell, not for that call, but they were hoping to get the next call that they could intimidate you. Now these people are all smart. These guys are, a lot of them are former players, which is wonderful to see, because they're wonderful, fair, very fair people. And, you know, they're good managers of people. That's why Mike Matheny and Brad Ausmus and go on down the list. That's why these guys get these jobs. They're good at handling. Buck Showalter, who's been a major league manager for a long time, he has that aptitude to be able to, you know, manage people. And if they've got a complaint, they do it in a professional manner. And Jim Evans always told me, a former major league umpire, that, you know, it's okay for professional people in a uniform, whether it's a player, coach, or manager, to argue, but as long as it's done in a professional manner. And it goes back to what they always say is, it's okay for agreeable people to disagree. And this crop of managers, especially in the last 10 years that I saw, were a lot friendlier, a lot nicer. Now, it didn't mean they wouldn't want to pitch in the eighth inning or were mad over a call or a ruling or a fan interference, but that's okay. I always respected their will to win. You know, they get paid on wins and losses, and just like the players get paid on statistics. And that's one thing that's changed also in our profession as umpires. There's more statistics on umpires now than ever.
Is there an optimum age for an umpire to be at the top of his game?
I really think, because I experienced this, being a minor league umpire as a young person and being a major league umpire as a young person, it took me 5, 7, 8 years to really figure out my job, especially at the big league level. And then when I got into my 35 to 45, that's, you know, I worked 4 World Series in that span. I got to work a lot of big games. That's when your physical abilities are at your best. That's when your temperament's really good. And then once you hit about 50, you start to slow down a little bit. Your reactions aren't as good. It becomes a tougher job. The games last a lot longer, as we all know and complain about. The games now, the average is over 3 hours. And, you know, every night you'll read 3 games go extra innings. So, and those games aren't that time's not compressed into the normal 9-inning game. So the games last a lot longer. The between breaks are longer. So I really think the guys that are really good umpires now, and I don't want to use names, but like a guy like Jeff Kellogg, who's probably 48 years old. My brother Bill, who's 40. 48 years old, 49 years old. That age group, Jim Reynolds, that, you know, Ted Barrett, those guys, when they're in their 40s, maybe early 50s, I think those are our leaders. Those are our strongest umpires. And it shows because those guys are the guys working postseason, and they're working the big games when they count the most.
Tim Welke is with us. You mentioned extra inning games. What was the longest one you ever had?
I remember a game in Cleveland, opening day in Cleveland, a couple times. One in the old stadium, the mistake by the lake. It was 22 innings, I think.
Oh, that's and nice. Then, and what, 40 degrees?
Yes, probably.
Oh, lovely.
Back when Cleveland was supposed to be good, that's when they had Joe Carter and those guys. And then I remember just a home opener in Cleveland just a few years ago, four or five years ago, opening day, of course, I was the crew chief and you work home plate. The game started at 3, and it ended about 9 o'clock at night.
Oof.
And the problem is, you started, and it was a nice day in Cleveland, but you start in the bright sunlight at 3 o'clock, and then you go through the shadows at 6 or 7 o'clock, and then you turn the lights on, and then it becomes a night game. So, and that's why sometimes those games, especially that start a little bit later in the day, you'll see a more dead period of people scoring when the shadows really come out, because it's hard for the hitters to see through the shadows, and it's definitely hard for the umpires to pick up the ball. You don't see the ball the whole way. You might see the ball the last half, and that's why games tend to go extra innings when those shadows come out.
Who were the people that helped you the most along the way?
I think I touched on that a little bit, but I would say, you know, Marty Springstead and Rich Garcia, Joe Brinkman, Jim Evans, Dave Phillips was a big influence on my career. And then I got a chance, you know, I came up through the ranks with guys like John Hirschbeck, a little bit behind Tim McClellan and Larry Young. Those were my peers of my age, and they were just wonderful people, good family guys. Our families became close. John Hirschbeck and I, we always went to spring training together. John always had his family there, and I did too. Those are the times I'll remember. Those were the best times I'll remember.
Coldest you were ever on a baseball field was where?
Oh, there's been a few of those. I remember in Detroit, Old Tiger Stadium. You know, they really try to get those home openers in. I think it was like 26 degrees and the wind was blowing. So it was probably, you know, the wind chill was in the teens. And I don't know how the players played, but I know it was cold for the umpires, that's for sure.
Hottest you were ever was where? Oh, Texas or Kansas City, right?
I would say Kansas City in the summer. Back when I started my career in 84, I was just an American League umpire. There were American League umpires and National League umpires. So we would just go to the 14 American League cities at the time. And then in 2000, we became Major League umpires, and now all the umpires go to the 30 cities. But I remember a couple Sunday afternoon games in Kansas City when they had the turf, that if you were working second base, first base, or third base, between innings, you would go stand in the dirt cutouts because your
right.
feet were turning into prunes. And there were all kinds of things that people did. I remember some of the players, the visiting players, would put like a cabbage leaf in their hat.
Right.
Because they were wearing the dark hats.
Right.
Just like umpires were. And those really hot days, sometimes the best place to be was home plate because you didn't have to stand on the turf.
Right. Favorite catchers that you worked behind?
Oh, there were some wonderful ones. I think Brandon Inge stands out as just a nice person. And I remember, as a young umpire, people like Bob Boone were very good. He was at the time he finished his career with the California Angels at the time, now the Los Angeles Angels. But even though he was way experienced and I was way under experienced, very fair. And of course, he was very good at catching the ball. Jim Sundberg, I remember being nice, and we're lucky. You know, that's the one person. I'm not saying you have a relationship, but you do talk. You talk about pitches and you talk about setup, and they would often ask, "Am I blocking you out?" or that sort of thing. So, we had a lot of wonderful catchers that, and they still do today.
Favorite pitchers.
I don't know that I really had a favorite pitcher, but I'll tell you, somebody just asked me the other day, what's the best game you ever saw pitched that I worked home plate? And in 2003, I had the World Series. I signed to the World Series, and that was the Florida Marlins and the New York Yankees. And that was the year the Marlins beat the Cubs when everybody thought the Cubs were going to be there. But I ended up having home plate in Yankee Stadium in Game 6. And the Marlins were ahead 3-2 in the series. And the Marlins that year had gotten Jack McKean in the middle of the year, and he was kind of an older fella even at that time, approaching 80 years old. And he managed that team, and they had a lot of success. And they had Josh Beckett, was just a young rookie. He was like 22 years old. And somebody asked before Game 6, the off day before Game 6, when we left Florida and went back to New York, he said, aren't you going to save Beckett for Game 7? He said, heck no, he's a horse. So he brought Beckett back on 3 days rest. Well, I had the plate that night and Game 6 at Yankee Stadium, and Josh Beckett pitched. And that's the best game I've ever seen working balls and strikes. There was no score, and he was just dominating. And then the Marlins scored a run in the middle of the game to take a 1-0 lead. And then a couple innings later, in the seventh or eighth inning, the Marlins scored another run to take a 2-0 lead. And the way he was pitching, it felt like he was ahead 8-0. Well, he pitched a complete game. I don't know how many hits or strikeouts or anything like that, but he just dominated. And that's when the Yankees were in their heyday. That's when they had all the stars. And we're probably favored to win, but Beckett, even though he was a young rookie, 22 years old, I've never seen in person a better pitch game. I have seen Nolan Ryan pitch very well. I've been behind the plate when he's had one-hitters because Julio Franco missed a pop-up in the second inning that fell in behind him. And, you know, he could dominate games like that also. But as far as importance in big game pitching, that was memorable.
And when that game was over, Yankee Stadium was quieter than St. Patrick's Cathedral during High Mass. You could hear the Marlins players celebrating on the field. You could hear their voices. That's how quiet it was in the stadium when Beckett beat Pettit.
And I don't know if the Yankees ever got a guy to second base. I just remember walking off the field. I think the last out was a comebacker to Beckett, and where he just flipped it over to
first
base.
Yeah.
And back then, to get to the umpire's locker room, we would walk towards the first base side to get to our locker room at the time. And I remember seeing him celebrate and getting in the locker room and realizing, geez, what a game he just pitched. And you know, that was towards I had been a 20-year guy by then, and still had a ways to go towards the middle of my career. But in person, big games, and although I was on first base for a couple different things, the night in April when Roger Clemens struck out 20 Seattle Mariners, I remember early in that game Don Baylor was playing first base for the Red Sox at the time. He wasn't DHing; he played first base. And about the third inning, I was the first base umpire. He turned to me and said, "You know what, Tim?" He said, because he played with Nolan Ryan in California.
Right.
He said, and I think Clemens had like 8 strikeouts in the first 3 innings. He said, he's got a chance for 20 tonight. And of course, Don proved he was correct. And I remember a few years later, when Don wrote his autobiography, he put in that in his book that he had commented to me that Clemens had a chance to make history that night. And he was right. You know, some of those autobiographies, maybe they stretch the truth. That wasn't stretching the truth, because Don called that one in the third inning.
3 of the 4 World Series that you had the New York Yankees in them. 1996, the return to prominence. 2000, the Subway Series against the Mets. And 2003, as you just detailed, when you had Beckett the night that he closed out the Yankees in 2003. But you tell a great story about Game 4 of the Subway Series at Old Shea Stadium, when the Mets had won Game 3, and now we're back in the series at 2 games to 1. It's at their place, and Derek Jeter's leading off against Bobby Jones.
Yes. The World Series is a lot like Super Bowls. When they show the wide panoramic view of, like, the opening kickoff, everybody in the stadium would be with their phones or their cameras take pictures. So there's a lot of flashbulbs going out. It's very distracting. Well, the World Series is the same way. People are there for the first time, and they want to document it. So they take pictures when the guy's going to take the first pitch or make the first pitch of the game. And that's what happened that night. So as Jones is delivering the pitch, you see out of your periphery, the stadium just lights up. But on that very first pitch, Derek Jeter hit a home run. And to me, that was remarkable that he had the focus to be able to concentrate on what he was trying to do, probably looking for a fastball, saying, if I get it here, I'm going to hit it hard, I'm going to swing, but not be worried by what was around him. And that's probably what made him so successful for his great career. And a fellow Kalamazoo kid, grew up in Kalamazoo, right where I'm at now. So for him to do that, that shows the magnitude of his success. And if anybody could do it, he could do it, because he could blot out everything on the outside and concentrate just between the lines.
You became an inspiration for your younger brother, Bill, who is now in his 18th year in the major leagues, and you guys worked on the same crew in 2005 and again from 2008 to 2010.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was wonderful to work, have an opportunity to work with him, and he's, as I said, at the stage in his career where he's getting success, getting a lot of postseason games and working big games, and people can count on him. And at the end of the day, I think the managers want him there because they know they're going to get a fair shake. I remember Bill came to me when I was. He visited with me in Chicago one spring, and he had a year to go to get his degree at Western Michigan. And he said, I think I'm going to go to umpire school. And I said, well, don't go, Bill, until you get your degree. Then you can go. And he worked a while in the minor leagues, and I was able to give him hand-me-down shin guards and chest protectors and masks and that sort of thing. And I'm proud of him and what he's been able to accomplish so far, and he's got a ways to go. So he's got to still have a young family, a couple still in school and a couple in college. So he's going to be around for a while, and hopefully his knees will last a little bit longer than mine did.
Let's hope. Memorable ejections.
I think it might have been my first one. I was in that first year I was filling in for somebody, and I was at third base in Boston, and it was an extra inning game. And there was a runners on first and second in an extra inning game. The visiting team was trying to bunt the lead run to third base, and there was a play at third, a force play that I called the visitor guy safe, the guy coming from second going to third. And all of a sudden, Ralph Houck comes running out, and he was the Boston manager, and he liked to throw his hat down and kick sideways, and that's what he did. So that sticks out in my mind. I when you're a young umpire, people test you. And
right.
I had a lot of ejections the first half of my career and very few in the second half of my career. Because, I learned how to talk to people instead of when they're yelling, there's no sense you yelling. Pretty soon they're going to be redundant and stop and run out of breath. And then you can say, okay, you want to talk about this? And that's part of being an umpire. It's not ball, strike, out, safe, fair, foul. It's dealing with people and not having minor situations become major situations.
Funniest thing a guy ever told you in an argument?
I'm glad you ejected me because now I can go get a beer. And just a couple years ago, a guy came up and said, hey, I haven't had a day off in about a month, and it was on a Sunday in September. He says, I haven't had a day off in a month, and all my fantasy football players are playing now. Would you please eject me? I said, no way. I said, I'm a pro football fan, and if I can't go watch, you can't either. You're staying in this game no matter what.
Wow, how about that?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, obviously you don't root for teams, but you root for successful people.
Sure. And now that I'm no longer on the field, I just told somebody today, I said, I was glad to see Minnesota get off to a good start. I think Paul Molitor is one of the classiest acts as a player and then as a manager, and I know they've scuffled the last few years getting off to rough starts. That doesn't mean I'm glad Kansas City's starting the season 0-3, but I'm glad. I think everybody should get an opportunity to win and be successful. And you know what? I could never say that to you or to anyone else 2 years ago when I was still active. And we don't umpire for people. You see, when you have a pitch, you see a ball, the catcher's glove, home plate, and a strike zone. I don't know whether the person's wearing white shoes or black shoes or a gray jersey or a white jersey. Same thing at first base. You see a ball, a glove, and a foot. And if you know, I love pizza, but if I worked in a pizza joint for 35 years, after a while, it would all look alike.
Right.
So it's the same thing, kind of being an umpire. But I do pull for people. And now that I'm retired, I can pull for the good guys.
And when teams are winning, Tim, nobody cares who the umpire is.
Nobody does. Nobody. They're happy. The little things don't bother them because they're all being successful, and you can feel that momentum. Those years when, like, Cleveland was really when they were always selling out at the Jake and having a lot of success. They just, you know, they were going to come back and win because they always did it, and kind of like the magic they were able to recapture last year. And when teams are going bad, they're grumpy, and they're maybe not going to go home and complain to their wives or yell at their wives or yell at their manager, but they're quick to kind of yell at the umpire. So.
Will we always have umpires, or is technology going to overtake the game?
I think you always have to have umpires because, first of all, who's going to call the check swings? Who's going to handle the throwing situations, and who's going to interpret the rules? I get it. I think the technology with the replay system is wonderful. That way there's no major mistakes, and whoever scores the most runs is going to win. Nobody's going to kick one in the eighth inning, miss a play at the plate that's going to cost somebody a run. That's the difference between winning and losing. So I love that. And I do get the balls and strikes that I don't know that technology is there to properly call the strike zone. I see these boxes on TV. And
oh, take them down. Take them down.
The box never changes.
Right.
Never. The size of the box never changes. It doesn't matter whether Dustin Pedroia was standing up there or Big Poppy, you know, who's 8 inches taller. The size of that box always stays the same. So you still have human beings put those boxes up there. And but as I said before about the replay system, I like how it is now, and I hope it stays similar.
Last, fill in the blank. Tim Welke knew he had a good day on the field when, fill in the blank.
We had nothing to do with who won or lost the game. That was a good day, and I often told that to my crew. As long as we can walk in the locker room after the game, and we had nothing to do with who won or lost the game, that was a good day. You know, some days you kick some days you wish you wouldn't have called that you were a little quick calling that breaking ball behind home plate, that sort of thing, and some days you didn't get in the proper position to make the correct decision, or you didn't think the shortstop was going to throw the ball to second base. You thought he was going to throw it to first base for the easier out, things like that. But the main thing is, it was a great day when we had nothing to do with who won or lost the game.
Do you miss the game?
I miss the guys, and I miss wearing the uniform. I don't miss the travel. I don't miss the grind. And I'm, as I said earlier, I'm looking forward to the next chapter of my life. I'm busy. I'm doing a lot of rehab as far as my knees, so I go to the gym every morning, get to walk the dog a couple times a day, and enjoy my wife and kids and grandkids.
Tim, to a lifetime of good days in your retirement. Thank you.
Ed, thank you so much. It's been wonderful chatting with you and your fans, and I hope you can call me anytime, and we'll talk soon, okay?
I love talking baseball with you. So that'll do it for Tim Welke and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.